Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Greetings, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host. You'll love me and like it. Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is my three sons superfan, Mr. Martin Kessler.
Hello.
No Fred McMurray impression? All right.
You were near for there for me, mother.
There we go. And joining us today is FlixWise art director, our biggest fan, Ms. Emma Gerard.
Hello.
And making his FlixWise debut, courtesy of the information superhighway, is Mr. Marcus Penn. Welcome to the show, Marcus.
Thank you for having me. It's really great being on a podcast that, you know, I actually listen to and have listened to long before, you know, this appearance. So it's really cool. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's an honor to have you on.
It makes my job go by. It makes work go by a lot faster listening to you. Oh,
that makes me so happy to hear. I'm glad we could be there for you. So Marcus is here to tell us why he thinks that it isn't enough that we have one Ben Stiller film in the FlixWise favorites list. Listeners will recall that the very first movie admitted to the list was Stiller's 2001 masterpiece, Zoolander. But apparently there is more than one diamond in that crown jewel of a career. So Marcus has asked us to consider whether or not Stiller's 1996 Jim Carrey vehicle, The Cable Guy, is one of the greatest films of all time. So, Marcus,
yes,
are you ready to give us your pitch?
I absolutely am.
All right.
Before I go, I encourage anyone to go to my site to read my misunderstood masterpiece piece on The Cable Guy. And basically what I get into there and what I'm about to say now is basically I think The Cable Guy is a time capsule for the 90s, specifically the American mid-90s. It's just as important of a Generation X film as, say, Clerks or Slacker or even, you know, Reality Bites, another Ben Stiller-directed film, whether you like that movie or not. And when I say time capsule, it just it branches off and it references so many things, like MTV back when it played actual music videos. The humor is very dark, but still, you know, accessible. I think it can be enjoyed by most ages. How do I say it? But in terms of just let me just go back to that time capsule comment for a second. It's one of those things where if you watch that movie, it really captures the 90s very, very well, from the pop culture references to, like I said, the music to the people in the movie, like, say, Jack Black, Jim Carrey, who was just the man, you know, especially at that time. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people gave that, still to this day, have given this movie a second chance, because it was sandwiched between, before Cable Guy and the dark comedy that it was sandwiched between, you know, Ace Ventura, The Mask, and Living Color. So that's what everybody expected from Jim Carrey, to just be like the loud, wacky, goofy guy. And then right after Cable Guy, we got Liar Liar, which was another typical Jim Carrey, goofy, whatever. And not to say he wasn't loud and goofy and wacky and Cable Guy, but it was way more dark. It was a lot more creepy. I just think dark comedies in general get a bad rap and they don't get a chance. So I think, you know, I think people weren't expecting Cable Guy to be what it was. And I think people need to go back and kind of look at it, you know, with the lens and with the information that, you know, I just gave. It's a great dark comedy and it deserves a second chance. Or a first chance in some cases. So.
Okay. Do you want to give us a little plot summary, just really quickly? What happens in the movie?
Sure. The Cable Guy is just about a character played by Matthew Broderick who he moves into an apartment. He needs to get his cable installed. And unfortunately, the wrong guy shows up, and it's Jim Carrey, a character played by Jim Carrey, who he turns out to be a little obsessive, and he doesn't really have any friends, and he wants to be Matthew Broderick's friend, and it just becomes this kind of stalker case, and things get way out of hand, and then things are turned around, and it's almost like Single White Female, but with guys, and it's a lot more funny. It's not a drama. It's more of a comedy, a dark comedy, but, you know, turns into a stalker case where Jim Carrey starts to kind of become way more invasive and almost ruins Matthew Broderick's life, his relationship, his family. But again, it's a comedy. I know I just kind of described it as like a thriller, but it's actually a dark comedy. So
Yeah.
That's what that's
okay,
about.
Okay, cool. All right. And you think this that Cable Guy is one of the greatest movies of all time?
Greatest comedies of all time.
Okay, all right.
Which, I mean, in the long run, I guess you could technically, yeah, one of the greatest movies. But I'd like to just kind of keep it in greatest comedies for now. I don't want people to throw stuff at me because I know. Yeah. You know, I would also like to add, and this ties in, I hope I'm not taking this podcast over by talking too much, but I do want to, and this ties into another one of your episodes, I believe. It was the Starship Troopers episode. I know that this, I'm completely genuine when I say how much I love Cable Guy and how much I think it's a very good, important, whatever movie, because I know, especially with comedies, a lot of people, they like things ironically and like, oh, this is so terrible that it's good, because Cable Guy was not received well when it came out, even though it made a profit. A lot of people had mixed reviews at best about it, but I do really love it. This isn't one of those things where it's actually a stupid movie, but it's so stupid I love it. No, I think the comedy is genuine. I think it's great. And I really appreciated the end of the Starship Troopers episode that you guys did, because you kind of talked about that for a second, how there's, you know, there's campiness in it, and sometimes it gets out of hand, especially with comedies, where it's difficult to tell if you really like this, or do you like it to be ironic because no one else likes it, so you want to be different, or, you know, anything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but this isn't one of those cases. Cable Guy is a legit good movie, you know, so.
All right, I love that. I love that you've asked us to consider this as a serious film, because you're right, it is often dismissed, and I think it is something worthy of consideration. That being said, but let's go around. I won't start, but let's go around and see what our other panelists thought of The Cable Guy. Martin, how about we start with you?
So this is my first time watching The Cable Guy.
Okay.
And well, I mean, the reason for that is because I'm not somebody who finds Jim Carrey especially funny.
Sure.
So that was kind of kept me away from it. But having finally watched the film, I think he's utilized well as somebody who sort of speaks in cliches and somebody who seems out of touch socially. But I think the thing I found most interesting about it is the way that it showed how maybe TV culture affects us. By the end, I think it gets a little on the nose for me, but I like the film, and I think it's interesting and funny.
Okay, all right. That's a one in the pro column. All right, I like it. Emma, how about you?
Yeah, I actually was... This was my second time watching it. I hadn't seen it in a really long time, and I remembered it being more about TV and its effect on our psyches than I remember. But I wasn't disappointed in it, because there was also this like really deep kind of psychosexual drama going on through the whole thing that really kept me engaged with it. I was kind of sitting there wondering, like, why would there be this like kind of Gen Xer movie about like this weird Freudian case of this like anal retentive guy? It's like his like neurosis is showing up in a stutter, and like his obsession with television because he's been like abandoned by his mother, and all these things like that were going on. So I was actually kind of impressed with that.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll just jump in with I guess I'm going to be the negative Nancy here.
Okay.
Because I think that this movie has a lot of interesting ideas, but I had some issues with the execution. And I know, Martin, you said you thought Jim Carrey was well utilized. I honestly think he's the weak link in this film. And I think it's because he's doing a caricature of a maladjusted, arrested adult caught in arrested development. I don't think he believes in the character. I think he gets caught up in the tics, and it's all very distracting to me. And I think this is a really nasty movie. As you mentioned, Marcus, there's several movies you can compare to this, the most famous probably being Single White Female. There's also Play Misty for Me. But it really recalled for me a movie called Chuck and Buck, the 2000 Mike White
man.
Movie.
Yeah. Yes. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, I mean, once you see it, you can't not see it, right? But the difference for me was just how Chuck and Buck treats that maladjusted character with so much more compassion, and you really believe Mike White as Buck. He, you know that guy, right? Whereas the Jim Carrey character, whatever his name was, I don't think we know. I don't think we ever actually got his name.
It's either Chip or at one point Larry Tate, Chip Douglas or Larry Tate. It's Chip, you know,
exactly something, some random TV character name, but. I don't know. Like, to me, the Jim Carrey performance kind of derails the whole film.
Huh.
That's my take. But I do think that there's a lot of interesting things going on. And sure. I appreciate that in the mid-90s, Judd Apatow and Ben Stiller and company all got together and were offered basically unlimited funds to make this very, very strange movie. So in that sense, I really do appreciate it.
Exactly. Yeah. And even what you said, like Jim Carrey, again, Jim Carrey is a guy, I didn't mention this, but he's a guy who I can only take in super small doses. And that's kind of the thing, too. I mean, the Cable Guy wouldn't be the Cable Guy without Jim Carrey. But for me, like, I think kind of like what you said, it's all the other stuff. It's like all the clips to, like, you know, Tabitha Sora and then Kurt Loder, like, that's so 90s. Or, like, to see Bob Odenkirk and David Cross while they were in Mr. Show, which is such an important, like, 90s sketch show, to see Janine Garofalo. Like, it's just, it's such a, like, a stew, like, a pot of, like, just things from the 90s that, you know, all together in one movie that is really what's, like, you know, such a very intriguing for me. Also, the tone, too. Like, even the color palette of the movie is pretty dark. And I wonder if that's done on purpose just to kind of, you know, make the ambiance, you know, even more on the nose that it's a dark comedy. So it's not all bright and bright colors.
Like this type of comedy, like I think in some ways this might have been a little bit ahead of its time because you see a lot more comedies with this kind of darker tone and a sense of discomfort becoming much more popular, like sort of after 2000, I guess. Like that Judd Apatow kind of comedy that's definitely come into popular appeal. So I was sort of wondering too if maybe the film had been made, you know, just a few years later. As much as we do talk about it being a time capsule, like a lot of those people weren't really names yet, and I wonder if it had just been, you know, made in the early 2000s, if it might have been a much better received film.
Yeah, I think so. I think there was an issue of expectations.
Because I think had it been made in the early 2000s, at that point we would have seen, you know, again, I don't want to give Jim Carrey too much credit, and I don't want to, you know, insult him too much, but I think by the early 2000s we would have seen Jim Carrey, you know, in roles outside of just like The Mask and Ace Ventura, where he's just running around saying, you know, stupid one-liners. So I think maybe, you know, we would have been more, you know, like maybe I think if this had been made after Zoolander. Mm-hmm. Which was 2001, I think it might have been received well. But then again, it might have been too much because I think after Zoolander, then I think maybe because of that time and all of Ben Stiller's connection, it might have been a different movie because then this would have somehow incorporated, you know, Vince Vaughn and Will Ferrell and it might have been overkill.
It could have been a much more, like I think Lady P, you sort of touched on something I agree with. And I think like there could have been a subtler version of this film made, you know, there could have been like the Punch Drunk Love version of the Cable Guy, or it could have been a little bit closer to something like King of Comedy. I think maybe especially if it was maybe more from Chip's point of view, the Cable Guy's point of view. But I think like for what it seems to be trying to do in this little bit broader kind of dark comedy, I think it's pretty successful, even though it's not totally to my tastes. I think so. Like I laughed pretty well. Like I mean, there's parts that made me laugh, like the thing that made me laugh the most actually is when they go to medieval times, and I mean the whole the sequence is great, but like when you have Janine Garofalo doing the whole like there were no utensils in medieval times, hence there are no utensils in medieval times, would you like a refill on that Pepsi, like I lost it laughing. Like it's so funny to me.
No, with the exact line, he goes, they didn't have utensils in medieval times, but they had Diet Coke, and she's like, dude, I got a lot of tables. Like she just breaks character for a second, like just get off my case.
But I mean, like to me too, medieval times sort of like epitomizes some kind of cultural phoniness, and like as grating as the Cable Guy character is, I think like he is sort of substituting just like these cartoonish cliches from television, from movies, in place of like a functional personality, which is kind of interesting. Like Well, like, you know, a lot of what we watch on TV is phony, emotionally phony. And I think maybe when somebody doesn't have the real life experience to develop a barometer of what's authentic or not, maybe they sort of act out in ways that aren't socially correct or feel emotionally real. And I think that's where a lot of the discomfort of that character comes from, which is why I think Jim Carrey kind of works in this film.
Really?
Sure. I want to hear what Pauline, because this is the second time she said really like that. So I want her to.
Well, Emma, hang on. I'll defer to Emma for a second. Hang on.
Okay. Well, what kind of bugs me about Jim Carrey's character is that it's like the first like act or two of the movie is really setting up like kind of where this guy's coming from and like what his problem is. And kind of linking it back to television, which is the level I guess we can all relate to because we all watch too much television, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Oh, but then its conclusion is like kind of like in the middle of the movie, it like kind of goes away right away, is that like his mom didn't take care of him. And so now he doesn't know how to find love. But then like the rest of the movie is driven by this like fear that this person who can't receive adult love is going to become violent, and like it's really like fear driven, which makes sense in like that it's being like a comedy thriller, like it adds to like the thriller element of it for sure. Mm-hmm. But like it, that was always nagging at me through like the second half of the movie.
Yeah, and the second half of the movie too, he seems to be able to ingratiate himself into social situations very expertly. It's not
I do like this concept that like there's just this corrupt society of people who all have free cable. He can like move anywhere he wants.
Well, do you think it comes down to more the Jim Carrey's performance or more the script? Because like I know Ben Stiller at first wanted to play the role himself and backed up because he thought maybe it was too much responsibility.
He would have been
director.
So much better.
So, like, do you think it's both the actor and the script, or is...
I mean, I think it's both. I think the major flaw for me is Jim Carrey. And don't get me wrong, like we've thrown a lot of shade at Jim Carrey, but I could watch Ace Ventura and laugh. Like, I think talking out of your butt is hysterical.
Let me just say, I can watch the first Ace Ventura. The second Ace Ventura,
the second, not
it's,
so
it's,
much.
It's so,
absolutely.
Like, it's just, like, crazily racist, honestly. Like, I hate to be that guy. It's one of the most racist
Please
movies
Please be that
ever
guy.
Made.
You're on the right show.
Well, it really is one of the most racist movies.
Yeah, okay.
But and I hate to divert, but like real quick, when I talk to people about Ace Ventura, and I'm like, that movie's so racist. Like so often, people are like, really? And I'm like, what do you mean, really? Like, of course, didn't you see the movie? Like, what movie were you watching? But anyway,
Yes, total agreement. Yes, Ace Ventura: When Nature Calls is offensive in every way. I think we can all agree. But I'm down to watch the first one. And yes, it is transphobic. The first one is definitely transphobic. But aside from that, like some of the gags are funny. I enjoy Jim Carrey making funny faces. And I also enjoy Jim Carrey, in his more subtler roles. Like I've liked him in The Truman Show. I've liked him in, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Man on the Moon. I think he's great in that. Eternal Sunshine, yeah. Actually, I think Man on the Moon is the movie where he's, like, best utilized because it requires some of that same rubber face kind of weirdo-ness along with some true emotional beats. Maybe?
I mean,
not so much?
Man on the Moon? Well, like, I heard that, like, they almost went with Edward Norton instead and just, like, that image stuck in my mind and now it's like, isn't right.
Is it right? Oh, I can't imagine
Edward
Norton
as,
in that role.
As Kaufman, I think that would have been really good. But I mean, sometimes it does, like almost any movie. Like sometimes it like does ruin your image of the finished film when you know that somebody else could have had the role and they could have maybe done something different with it, and it's like.
Yep.
Permanently sullies the film experience in some way.
That's true. But so back to the cable guy. You asked whether it's an issue with script or with Jim Carrey, and I think it's both. I think there's a lot of inconsistencies with the script, and I think that partially because the script writer was initially trying to make a movie like What About Bob, where it's just kind of this irritating cable guy who won't leave him alone, and Jim Carrey wanted to take it in another direction. So there was sort of this discord between what's happening in the script and what's happening with Jim Carrey and like some last minute changes. So that could account for part of that. And I actually think Jim Carrey's kind of right. Like, I think it's more interesting than What About Bob? I appreciate that it went in another direction. And I think that there's a lot of really interesting things that the movie's trying to say about television and about just plain old how we interact with people and just kind of stranger danger. And I think stranger danger was definitely a thing in the mid-90s. But, you know, we associate it with, like, children and, like, how, like, we just have this basic mistrust of other people. It just sort of taps into those fears. It's almost a horror movie.
Sure, I love at the beginning when he comes back and, like, he's like, oh, I'm going to set up your cable. Matthew Broderick comes back later and, like, all the furniture is rearranged. I was like, oh, it's Poltergeist. Yeah.
Totally.
Well, the whole dream sequence that's very... Yeah, I mean, it's meant to be funny, but it's also kind of horrific when he's got the little contacts and there's the dark light. And,
yeah.
And he's chasing after him. Nice. Yeah, yeah. But even what was said earlier, like, for, you know, okay, so for example, when he comes back, the furniture's rearranged, and the whole relationship between Matthew Broderick and Jim Carrey, it's like, you know, like, Matthew Broderick's a timid guy, where, like, realistically, you come back, and it's like, put my furniture back, but he's just yeah. like, oh, okay, like, that's kind of Matthew Broderick's performance throughout the whole movie. He's just timid at first, like, oh, you're weird, but I don't want to say anything, which I have plenty, I think we all have experiences like that, where it's like, oh, you're a little... You're coming on a little too strong, but I don't want to say anything just yet. And then it just gets out of hand, and that's kind of, you know. And I like that dynamic between the two in that movie, yeah. You know.
Yeah, it's like how far can you take social niceties?
The people who try to inflict a friendship on you.
Yeah, exactly.
even the scene after Medieval Times, you know, when he tells him, he's like, look, I just don't have time for a friend. It's like such a rehearsed, you know, like robotic speech, and he's a little uncomfortable saying it. And it's just, I've been there, not specifically in that kind of case, but I've been in those positions before. So it's like, so, you know, it's weird. So on one hand, Cable Guy gets really unrealistic and crazy, but at the same time, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, we can all relate to in a really awkward, kind of cringy, you know, way, and I really like that. And
yeah, I mean, and in a sense, I can absolutely relate to the Cable Guy because, you know, I love TV too. So I think when you're a kid, you watch when I was a kid and I watched the movie, I was like terrified of the Jim Carrey character, and I think as you get older, you can kind of see a version of yourself in the Cable Guy. You're like, or like, that's your worst nightmare. It's like, I don't know, like, not that you have to interact with that guy, but that you become that guy, right?
Well, it's like once per podcast where I'll like make a joke that doesn't land, or like say something where I just want to die of embarrassment. Like, it's, you know, yeah. At least you hope that you have the self-awareness not to be that person. But like, I mean, even the way they communicate sort of in pop cultures when they say like, oh, I feel like Felix Unger, and you know what that means, it's you know, I sort of feel like, oh, maybe I need to just find better ways to express myself.
I know, right?
Oh, I was just wondering, I was kind of viewing the movie like Matthew Broderick and Jim Carrey's character. When I was viewing the movie, it seemed to me like there was this twin motif going on, obviously, with like Ben Stiller's character being on TV all the time in the background with the murder trial, and it seemed like maybe Jim Carrey's character and Matthew Broderick's character were supposed to be like mirrors of each other too. Mm-hmm. Like Matthew Broderick's character clearly isn't happy in his social life.
Wow, you know, that's good. So oh, I like that. Wow.
Like, there's like this aspect of him being like, he has to kowtow to this idiot with like hair plugs, which are like this other like false masculine thing. And like, he's like as rehearsed and awkward in his relationship with his on and off girlfriend as he is with the Cable Guy that he can't get rid of.
Right, so. Right.
And my favorite scene in the movie is when he has to play adult password with his family. It's like, that's the ultimate fear. This like socially awkward person is going to make us talk about sex with our family, was at least in Matthew Broderick's world.
Yeah. It's pretty.
Yeah. No, I was just gonna. I'm glad you brought up that the trial, because even before we let's say get into it, I do want to say, like, for those that don't know, you know, that trial was referencing the, you know, the Menendez brothers. Yeah. And I give Ben Stiller credit, because we're talking the mid 96 when this movie was, you know, made, and like anything, it was always about OJ. So to completely ignore OJ Simpson and talk about this other, you know, Menendez brothers trial, like, I give him credit for that, because it's such like an easy laugh to, hey, let's make an OJ reference. Everybody's doing it. And it totally, like, for a movie that was all about the 90s, you wouldn't have even think they knew about OJ Simpson, because they just kind of like ignored it and went the Menendez brothers route, which I, you know, who even remembers that? I mean, I do. I was a teenager at the time.
Right. But, they're the ones that killed their parents, right?
Yeah.
Yeesh. But yeah, I mean, that's true. That was probably a wiser play, although the O.J. Simpson case is hot right now, as we all know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Maybe we'd be getting more play. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think the trial is doing in there? I like Emma's take a lot, like just the twin motif. But otherwise, yeah, it just feels like it might be part of a different movie.
Well, I think like there is a connection, because it's sort of showing you people who are hurt by the entertainment industry on the other side. You know, it's showing... Mm-hmm. In the foreground with the Jim Carrey character, somebody who's being hurt by pop culture, TV culture, from watching it, and these people are being hurt by making it. That, like, I mean, we all sort of know about the child stars being kind of wrecked by the entertainment industry. You think about Corey Feldman or Corey Haim. That kind of reminded me a little bit of that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. And I think, like, not only does it highlight the personal lives that are destroyed by Hollywood, but it's criticizing the American public and our endless appetite for these kind of trashy, salacious court cases, which, you know, even though it is, this is a 90s, you know, it's very of its time. I mean, we still cannot get enough of the sideshow that is the American justice system, I guess. I don't know. Whenever famous people get into trouble, we seem to really enjoy watching it. So I guess, like, and that's kind of where the media critique comes into this movie. And so I'm also wondering, what do you guys think of the critique specifically? Like, that's another piece of this film that kind of feels like a relic. Like, I feel like we've just completely embraced television as a culture. We just have totally foregone all the criticism. And I don't think that's necessarily unfair or wrong of us to do, because TV is not what it once was. There, on the one hand, there's, you know, news stations, which are exactly what they once were. But on the other hand, the market for TV is so fragmented, and there's so many niche interest things. And in this age of cord cutting, like, big television networks or like mindless entertainment is not like, it doesn't feel as foisted on us as it once did, maybe. So I'm wondering what you guys make of the social critique.
Yeah, I think it's that, but I don't think it's trying to, it's obviously on the nose, like someone said earlier, but I still think they're trying to poke fun of it. They're not trying to make the most serious critique. They're trying to make a critique, but they're also not trying to, you know, because the movie's a comedy, so I think if they wanted to make like a serious critique on how television shapes us and everything, it would kind of be pointless, and wouldn't really make the cable guy a comedy. So
I don't know.
You know,
I think you can make a satire about how we interact with media, and I think that's kind of what he's doing.
Sure. Yeah. You know? I guess that's true. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it is even funny when it's like, when, like, at the end, after the cable's been shut off, and you have, like, Kyle Gass looking like a cherub reading a book, like, it's also sort of, yeah, I think you're right that it's not taking it super seriously, that, like, oh, if we're cut off from TV, we'll all be freed. It's, it treats that a little bit like a joke, too.
Well, it's everyone. Yeah, no, it goes from, like, household to household, which is funny because that scene, in a way, mirrors, like, towards the end of, say, The Truman Show, when it's, like, one by one, everyone's watching, you know, on their television. So that's a very a similar scene. But, yeah, no, everyone, like, when it cuts to the medieval times people and they're all pissed off, like, what do we do without television? Which is funny because nowadays, like, when we don't have any Wi-Fi, or something, like we can't use our phones or something. We're like, God damn it, what do I do now?
So it's very true.
Well, it's funny, the world he's describing, saying, oh, you're going to be able to play Mortal Kombat with your friend in another country, you'll have TV on your phone. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the world we're living in, exactly.
Absolutely.
He's warning the 90s about us.
Exactly, yeah. It has all been borne out. And so maybe, I guess that's also part of why it feels like such a... It's a time capsule, but it also feels like it's kind of the critique is kind of dated. In that, I don't know that it was going after the right targets exactly. Like, on the one hand, I like that there is, like, some... He's trying to say something about what we think of as entertainment and how we have substituted culture for human interaction. That's a potent message, but on the other hand, like, I don't know, it also feels a little bit silly because we've seen it borne out, and it's been like, it's a mixed bag like anything else, so it's like the kind of heavy-handedness of the message, I think, kind of dates it a little bit. Also, I mean, Ben Stiller, you mentioned Reality Bites earlier, Marcus, I think. He has a similar kind of anti-corporate, anti-television critique in that film as well. So this is clearly something he wanted to address in his work. And that sort of segues to one thing that I do kind of want to talk about, which is I mentioned that Zoolander is already on the FlixWise favorites list. Clearly, Ben Stiller's got something going for him, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
What can we talk about Ben Stiller as a filmmaker?
Sure.
Because I guess he's come. What is Ben Stiller exactly? I'm not even sure. He's so many things.
This kind of like relates back to what you were just saying. I think it's really interesting. It's like he's one of the most, like, he's one of the richest, most successful people in Hollywood. And he's directed all these movies that are like deeply cynical about entertainment.
Mm-hmm. yeah, exactly. And
let's also not forget the Ben Stiller Show. Like every other sketch on the Ben Stiller Show is exactly what you guys. And that was kind of his first foray, into filmmaking. So I feel like every other sketch on the Ben Stiller Show was like a parody of pop culture or like a backhanded critique on, something. And even that, there's certain sketches throughout, it was only one season, the Ben Stiller Show, that really kind of like transferred into the Cable Guy, like his dark humor. Even like a movie, like he didn't direct it, but like his performance in Heavyweights, like that character he plays, mm-hmm. like there's a darkness, there's a, like his character's pretty messed up, and I see, and it goes back to, I saying how Ben Stiller originally wanted to play it. I'm glad he didn't, because I think when Ben Stiller, sometimes he gets caught up in playing that character from Heavyweights, because the character from Heavyweights is the same guy in Dodgeball, you know what I mean? Like it's the same, like he plays that same guy, so I'm glad he wasn't the Cable Guy. But it is interesting what you guys are all saying about it, his critique and just his how there is a common thread throughout everything he's done. And I think it all goes back to two things. One, it goes back to, I think, the Ben Stiller Show, and also, his two parents. Like he came up in that world, so he kind of knows it.
When they showed that condo model, did anyone else want somebody to knock it over and say, what is this, a center for ants?
A condo for ants!
Wait, what?
When they showed that model for the condos near the beginning of the film,
right?
There were just a few little motifs and things that come up through Ben Stiller's other films, not just thematically but visually. Like, there's the scene where they're making out during the party, and I was thinking how similar it was visually to the orgy in Zoolander, or.
It does look like that.
Oh my God, it is.
Even if somebody hadn't told me, I think, like, you could make an educated guess, like, oh, this is a Ben Stiller film, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he frames, like, discussions the same way all the time. In an interesting way, he puts characters in the middle of the frame. I think he's into, like, symmetry. Mm-hmm. It's almost, his framing is almost Wes Anderson-y. In some regards, especially in Zoolander, where it's such, like, there's so much production design. Mm-hmm. And that he does the he yeah it's his conversations are shot in a very Ben Stiller-y way. So it's funny that we think of him as you know, this primarily as an actor, but he does have a distinct visual style. Well, there you have it, Ben Stiller, American auteur.
You guys are making me think about. I've never thought this deeply about, and not to insult the man, but I've never thought this deeply about his entire filmography until now. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. interesting. Wow.
Genius.
Thank you, guys.
All right, cool. Well, I think that's as good a place as any to ask the final question. Let's have our ruling, shall we? Emma looks undecided. I don't know. But all right. So, do you guys think that the Cable Guy is worthy of the FlixWise favorites list? I'll go first since I'm the party pooper here. I'm gonna go with no, just because I think it's kind of like it's an interesting time capsule, that's for sure. And I love time capsules, don't get me wrong, but I don't think it's the best version of this story. I think there's a very good case to be made for Chuck and Buck. But I don't know, like, there's a lot of really interesting stuff in here, and I did love that medieval times piece. I think that's hysterical.
Can I just say, also, I grew up in Massachusetts. All I knew pretty much growing up was either Massachusetts or New York City, because those were the two places I'm from or whatever. But I thought medieval times was made up for that movie. I didn't know that until I went to college. Yeah, no, apparently, like, there's a bunch in New Jersey. Like, I went to college, and I was watching Cable Guy on my laptop, and then my friend, I happened to casually mention, like, man, I wish medieval times is a real place. And like everyone in the room, it was like that record skip, like, what are you talking about? It is a real place. And I'm like, well, and I was so embarrassed. I was 21. I had no idea. They were like, it is a real place. They're all over New Jersey. They're in Pennsylvania. I was like, are you serious?
Yeah. Have you been?
No, I still haven't been.
You must go.
I know.
When you come out here to LA.
Yeah, we got one out here. Yeah, okay. Costa Mesa. Okay. Next time you're in town. Okay, but medieval times segment aside, I'm gonna vote no. But I'm very curious to hear what the rest of you think. Martin, what do you say?
I think it's an underrated film, but like you said, I don't think it's the best possible version of the story, as much as I hate medieval times. I think maybe if it had been approached, I don't know how much of this is just like my personal taste, but I think if it had been approached a little bit more like King of Comedy, I think those satirical elements might have felt stronger, actually. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not worthy of the FlixWise movie list, but anyone who avoided it should give it a watch, if you're like me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. That I can get behind. Emma, what say you?
Yeah, I'm going to say no for all the same reasons that you guys pretty much went over.
Yeah, yeah. But
I agree, it's worth watching.
Yeah, I think we can agree. Not quite. I don't know that I would call it one of the greatest movies of all time, but certainly worthy of consideration. And Marcus, glad that you brought it to our attention.
Thank you. And every you guys all said no, and that's fine. But everything you said, each one of you, that's as a true fan of this film, like that's kind of all I need to hear, because for years this movie, a lot of people who remembered seeing it when they were teenagers and then they were adults, like, oh, that movie's dumb. I think a lot of people don't give it a second chance. So that's all I can ask for, is just people or you know, that's all I want to hear, is just someone say it's worthy of watching, or it's pretty good, or it had some interesting stuff, because for years it didn't even get that much credit. So I've succeeded in whatever I, you know, wanted to do.
Yes. Just, you know, so. Mission accomplished.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Alrighty then, that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. Listeners, do you think The Cable Guy is one of the greatest movies of all time? Come tell us why on our website, FlixWise.com. If you want to follow our every move, just like us on Facebook at Facebook.com/FlixWise. And perhaps you think I'm the unstable one for voting it down. Well, you can come find me and tell me I'm nuts on Twitter. The handle is at FlixWise. Dear Lord, what am I inviting? I ask myself that every time. But before you do all of that, be sure to show your undying loyalty to us by rating our show and leaving us a nice comment on iTunes. truly will be friends forever and ever if you just give us that 5-star rating. Pretty, pretty please. On our next show, we're back on Sight and Sound duty with Pontecorvo's 1966 feature, The Battle of Algiers. Until then, Marcus.
Yes.
Thank you so much once again for presenting the cable guy for the FlixWise favorites list.
Oh, no. Thank you for having me, please.
Yes. And I hope this is the first of many appearances on our show.
I do too.
All right. Awesome. Martin, thank you as always.
Pleasure as always.
All right. Emma, back to the boob tube.
Anything for you, buddy.
Yay. All right. Remember, listeners, don't let televisions raise your children. Podcasts, however, make for perfect babysitters. Good night, everyone.